So this is continuing with Jim Hindman on 14 March
78. Anyway, we decided to expand our frequency range on the sun. There wasn't much of interest at 1 centimeter. It was pretty smooth, unchanging except for minor, minor bursts on 1 centimeter, but right. They were probably bloody big ones, other frequencies. So we built a 10 centimeter radiometer, much the same principle. And later we changed the 1 centimeter to 3 centimeters, and we spent quite a number of years, in fact, observing.
When you say we now, is it still Piddington and Minette?
No, Minette had dropped out. I'd moved to work with Christensen, actually, who was then running most of the solar work. And I ran the microwave solar work with him. He went on above the 10 centimetres, 25 centimetres, and to the longer wavelengths. And it was out of that work that the first paper you put down there came in.
Christensen and Hindman, 51.
The background.
In Nature, yeah. And this is putting together work, data taken over 4 years, which was before you really got involved with this data, I gather. The 25 and 50 centimeter data.
Yeah, I hadn't had anything to do with the taking of those.
Of the earliest data, part of it, anyway.
Only the 10 centimeter part of it. I think it actually, that bit of information came up simply because of the method of plotting that I'd adopted to try and compare with the sunspots.
What was that method?
It was just a matter of plotting sunspot area in one direction, radiation level in the other direction, and seeing what the correlation between sunspot and area and radiation level was at 10 centimeters. It seemed to be pretty bloody good. But we always had this peculiar situation that it never quite went through zero. And when we tried it out on the longer wavelengths, it got even worse. The line went further up from zero. And Chris then fairly quickly woke up to the fact that we were looking at an underlying effect. So we went through the 4 years records and picked up the fact that it was slowly dropping away.
At the base level itself was actually varying.
Yeah.
Probably due to the fact that the solar cycle was...
Yes, we were moving a fair way through the solar cycle, essentially. And fortuitously, I think we started on the down side of the curve, too. We'd started off our work on 1 centimeter, practically up the peak of the cycle.
Is it fair to say this is your first publication, and you had not been a co-author before? Were you more or less learning the ropes about...
That was the first...
What was going on?
Yeah.
And switching more into the scientific side of it.
Yeah, that's right.
By that stage.
Well, I've never taken a degree of any sort.
Never even all through the 60s and
not,
so forth?
Not through the whole period.
Well, that's one of the interesting...
Always found work was much too demanding.
That's, of course, one of the interesting aspects of this field, is that there are so many people that... only a couple that don't have any degree, but many that have only a bachelor's degree and so forth, which is highly unusual, of course, in 20th century.
As a matter of fact, not very long before he died, Joe Pawsey said to me that there were a lot of people that had been involved in radio astronomy, but whenever he thought about it, he always felt that some of the most substantial contributions had been made by people who wouldn't have, in the first place, been chosen as... people to work in a research field. And he particularly named Gordon Stanley and myself as being two outstanding examples of this sort of thing happening. I think it's just a question of an aptitude for something, and we had very good background in electronics and physics.
Well, this is, of course, a modern phenomenon about having had these degrees in the 19th century.
I think it's pretty necessary. I mean, you couldn't enter radio astronomy now and pick up enough background to know where to start. I mean, in those days, it just didn't exist, so you could shoot in and do anything you liked. You're going to discover something almost.
All right, continuing on with the early solar work that you did, the only other paper... connected with that is a one with many co-authors on a couple bursts that happened in 1950, where you...
We had actually continuous solar observation going on quite a number of frequencies, about 7 frequencies.
See, what was your main field site at this time?
That was the main thing, to keep a continuous run, look at the sun going at as many frequencies as we could accumulate.
But at which location were you working mainly?
Oh, I was partly at Potts Hill site and partly at Dover Heights. There were other sites being used.
When you were at Dover Heights, were you using the CN interferometer or just looking straight at
it? No, just looking directly. Yeah. In fact, at one stage we moved the 10-centimetre and 3-centimetre equipment to Dover Heights to have it close to the... It was about 200 megacycle equipment.
Why did you want to have it close?
Oh, just to cut down the number of people. That was the
Being
used on the sun. Yeah. It was just a question of cutting down the number of people who were involved in this observatory-type work, which one expected might bring some results, but it was going to be a long-term thing and didn't want to tie everybody down to it. I had other people like Gil Trent, for instance, who's still around here somewhere.
Yes.
He and George Fairweather, who's long since left to become a poultry farmer or something like that. And they used to run this equipment day in, day out for as many hours as you could keep it on the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So the result, that particular paper was the result of that continuing observatory operation.
One of the more spectacular bursts.
It was a really spectacular show, and it went on over the whole frequency range for hours, even at 3 centimetres. It lasted for something over an hour and a half.
Well, while this was going on, I gather that the next stage in your career would be that word came of the 21-centimetre hydrogen line.
That was another peculiar thing. Once again, Piddington was instrumental in starting me into it. He had read van der Holst's wartime paper and felt that we might just have a chance of detecting the H-line.
Now, when was he saying this?
This would have been about 1950.
A year before it was.
And so he asked me to do some spare time assembling of equipment to see what we could pick up.
Is that right? I just talked to him yesterday. He didn't mention this.
Didn't he? Oh, he's forgotten it. there was a bit of a problem here that I started to assemble this equipment, but I found that I didn't know where I was in the frequency spectrum to the sort of accuracy that was required. Mm-hmm. And it took me a long while to find out, many, many weeks, to find out that one Wilbur Christensen had the only generator that was available in Sydney that could do things to anything like this accuracy.
Had enough stability and frequency.
And when I went to see if I could borrow this thing from him, it was pretty obvious that he also was trying to get this hydrogen line. And he had a completely different receiver set up.
Mm-hmm.
And his wasn't working very well at all. Mine was quite sensitive, I knew that. I didn't know where I was in frequency, so I was having no luck seeing anything. And incidentally, we were both working on the same area.
And you didn't know it?
We didn't know about it.
How many months did this go on before you discovered it?
Oh, 2 months, I would think. I was on this side of this area in a trailer, and Chris was on this side in a hut.
This
we were not more than 20 feet apart.
Amazing.
This is the section of a parabola type area.
Yes, that's right.
And located where now?
That was out at Potts Hill.
At Potts Hill. But now, this all is taking place, when is it? Can you place it in which month?
It would probably be around about February, March of 51.
So, March 51, or April, I forget exactly now, is when the Harvard people detected
it. That's right. Well, April, later in April, was when we first saw it, too, only a week later, 2 weeks later.
Well, hold on now. First of all, did you know about the Dutch and Harvard attempts?
We didn't know about the Dutch attempt. We didn't know about the Harvard attempt. While we were doing this, Purcell had written, because Frank Kerr was at Harvard at
right.
the time,
right.
And asked us, could we possibly assemble equipment to check on this upstart that was doing a thesis, which he was likely to waste because if he came to the end of it and didn't get an answer, he wasn't going to get his doctorate.
Right. But now he has to do this before the detection. I mean, this is
yes.
several months before.
Mm. Well, once I got Chris's signal generator and fixed frequency, almost immediately started to get some results. But at least we didn't get any actual detection of the thing. We were confident of where we were in frequency, but we then were able to start to search a little bit to find out just how we were placed with regard to various places in the galaxy. And of course, with the galactic center going nearly overhead, that was our main
right.
aim to look in that direction. But it only came around once a day, and it wasn't coming around at the right time of the day. And at that stage, I got myself I tripped on this aerial, and I ended up having to have a cartilage out in the knee.
Which there's still evidence of here.
You see that. And
did that slow down the effort?
Well, it didn't, as a matter of fact. Chris carried on, took over where I left off with the observing. And the morning that I had the cartilage out, I came back from the theatre. There was a telegram waiting for me to say something to the effect that we've got it. The first detection had occurred that evening.
So you unfortunately missed
that
it.
Evening. So. Yes. I convalesced very quickly. Came back to work in between having physiotherapy treatment, one thing and another, and ploughed on with that initial survey, which resulted in the
Christensen and Heinlein
original paper.
Papers. But when do you remember this detection being?
I can't quite place this thing. I think it was round about May, it might have been early June or something like that.
See, now here...
I could probably put a date on it sometime.
Pausing's telegram is yeah. dated July 12th.
Yeah.
It says, referring Professor Purcell's letter of June 14th announcing the discovery of hyperfine structure, confirmation has been obtained by Christensen and Heinemann. Now, the standard story, which I myself have been giving in various talks I give, is that only when you got the word did you then quickly slap together a receiver from Purcell. But you're clearly telling me that that's not true.
No, well, as I say, Purcell didn't announce that Harvard had seen it.
Until June,
it was,
apparently.
It was several months before that. He had said that he had this upstart student who was working on this project.
Kerr said that.
Wanted somebody to...
So in fact, this just made you go faster when you heard
yes,
about
it. Yes, we knew somebody else was there, and there was a special reason for getting a detection. At that time, we didn't have a clue that the Dutch people were on the thing at all. It wasn't until Nature contacted us
really?
With that we realized that the Dutch were in it also.
You sure nobody knew? Well, maybe you didn't know that.
No.
But it seems like you would have if anyone down here had, because, see, the point is that Vanderholtz was also at Harvard, and Kerr and Purcell certainly knew about the Dutch effort, which had been going on for a couple of years. But you don't...
Yeah, Kerr hadn't said anything about it, and it was only later, I think, that we realized that the Dutch had had their upset with the fire, and one
thing
or another, that had put them back 12 months.
I see. So that's interesting. So that actually you were working on it for several months before... You found out that the Harvard people had detected the line.
And as I say, it wasn't more than days after they read out, or cabled out, to say that they had, you and had finally detected it, that Christensen
it was
sat through the night and saw the same result on our equipment.
What were the particular technical difficulties in detecting this line?
Well, sensitivity was one problem. I mean, all our sensitivity prior to that had been based on wide band receivers. When you had to narrow the band down to 20 kilocycles or something of the sort, it was an unheard of sort of narrow band. In fact, I think our success was due to the fact that I devised a means of loading an oscillator cavity with a reactance which was being switched in a capacity switch which had been built for 25 centimeter work, which I quickly modified.
I see.
And I used this switch to load the cavity in such a way that it just pulled the frequency.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't quite know how far it was being pulled. It was a megacycle or so, I think, a megacycle and a half. And by doing that, we were able to get this sweep through the line as the frequency, as the thing drifted across. We got two bits of information, one on the line and one off the line.
Well, let me get it straight now. As the galaxy moved through the beam, you're saying, you were switching between two frequencies.
Yeah.
At what sort of a rate?
Oh, 25 cycles.
So you're switching fast between two frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And so then you should see, but you have a single channel.
Yeah.
So you should see a drift curve.
Well, no, what we did then was slowly swept the channel with our final intermediate frequency oscillator, and that then gave us this peculiar double shaped.
I see. And so there was enough time while the source was drifting through the beam to do this.
I mean, we had a beam that was it must have been 10-14 degrees wide or something.
I see.
But it was not plenty of time.
Yeah, it was not a steerable dish, though.
No. Well, yes, we could steer this dish. And that's how we did the survey. In fact, because we could steer the dish, we were able to do the survey. But at the time of observation, all we were doing was leaving it fixed while the sky drifted past. And in fact, the only steering we did at the time was to change the declination each night during the survey. And we ran through the night collecting these profiles, double profiles, right through the 24-hour period, and then we changed declination again, another overlapping run.
When you say double profiles, you mean they turned out to have two peaks?
Oh, well, no, that was, I wasn't thinking of them as double profiles at that time. That was a later realization from the shape of the thing, but the form of the equipment was such that in doing our sweeping and switching at the same time, we alternatively saw the line in one channel.
Oh, I see what you're
one
saying.
One side of the channel or the other. So our
first would be a negative
profile on the recorder was a double thing, went in both directions.
I see. But now you use frequency switching then, basically.
Yes, that was the main.
Which, of course, is the key to doing this and the other detections also.
Yeah.
But did you get that idea through Kerr from Harvard? Something that you thought was obvious to do?
I think it was just one of those things that was obvious from the particular equipment that we happened to have lying around. And as I say, I tried it out on a cavity. In fact, I had a variable sliding line, and by just leaving it open circuit and feeding it into the, putting a loop into the cavity and switching it, I was able to juggle the length of it, and I got a reactance in the cavity when it was switched onto the cavity, which just pulled the frequency and didn't kill it or do something silly. It was pure trial and error situation. But once you landed on a suitable switching gap in the frequency, well, you were right.
Hmm. Just to get this straight, the dates were March 25th for Harvard, May 11th. In Holland, 6 weeks later, and then your own was middle of June sometime.
Mm-hmm.
So you did start later than the other groups, but in fact it was still before you had the word about the detection.
I think we had actually started to assemble a receiver quite a while before any of those dates.
Right, but sometime like the beginning of that year, whereas these people had been working for a year, a year or two.
It was just, as I say, Piddington, as I remember, was the one who came to me with the idea that we should try and do something about it, because we maybe could do.
But then why did he not stay with it, in terms of...
I'm not quite sure. I think he was well tied up with other jobs that he was doing. It was just a thought he had. He had somebody who was competent with equipment floating around who could give it a go. And then, of course, once Christensen and I got together on it, and Chris was also a very competent instrumentalist, and Jack Piddington sort of got left out at that stage, because at that point it was a question of making a receiver to detect this thing, not trying to find out too much in the way of what it involved in the galaxy or anything else.
Well, the other thing you said was that you did it in your spare time, at least in the beginning. So you were working on the sun mainly.
That's right.
At what stage did it shift over to more than a spare time activity?
Well, at the stage when we thought we had something that could possibly detect the line, and we had needed then to observe for 24 hours a day.
So this is when you located the oscillator
and
joined forces with Christensen.
Yeah, you had to sort of stay with it after that, because you always had the possibility of frequency shifting. In fact, you had to check the frequency every quarter hour or so.
Right.
Stop it drifting off.
And at some stage in here, I suppose you got Quasi's approval to be working on this thing.
Yeah. I've got a feeling, I'm not sure about this, but I think that Pawsey had mentioned the job to Christensen. There'd been sort of two independent Piddington and
Pawsey
ideas to have a go at it and see what was going on.
Well, I've talked to Christensen, and I'll have to recheck that interview to see what he said, but I didn't remember all this. Okay. Very interesting. So, having this detection, this telegram was sent to Nature. And then, of course, it was clear that you wanted to follow this up. And so, did you just simply use this first equipment without any improvements?
We just used that equipment without changing anything. We straight ahead.
What was the program then?
Well, the program was simply to run 24 hours a day on varying declinations from as far south as we could get up to our northerly limit, which is about plus 60 declinations. We could go to the pole, so we covered most of the sky. And we did it, we attempted to do it twice. I think there were areas where we didn't get two runs, and then we set to break it down into some indication of where in the sky we could expect to detect the thing. The main idea, basically, was to get a diagram which said, okay, while you're observing this, these are the places to... look. So
this is where the hydrogen is. You did it twice for purposes of reliability.
Yes. Just
did you find the fact that they did repeat reasonably well?
They were pretty reasonable. 20% changes.
Oh, I know another question. Is where did you come up with this 20 kilohertz bandwidth? What was that based on?
Oh, just a guess at what I could produce on a 7 megacycle filter, which had to be built into the system. It was how much bandwidth you could get down at a reasonable frequency to which you could convert.
So it was as small as you could go? You would have gone smaller if you could have?
Yes, probably. And would have probably missed. That was quite fortuitous.
So there really wasn't any astrophysics that went into it?
No, none at all. Well, neither Christensen and I were astronomers.
Right. What about the 1.5 megahertz frequency switching? That just seemed like a...
That was just as far as I could get the cavity to pull without plopping out of oscillation.
But wouldn't it be easy to just shift a small amount in terms of receiver stability?
Yes, I suppose it would have been. I didn't even think of it. We were dealing with 1400 megacycles. And to shift it 1 megacycle was a pretty small amount anyway.
But you weren't thinking about, well, it might be sort of a broad line, I better shift it pretty far. So there was a bit of luck here.
There was a lot of luck.
In terms of the instrumental parameters versus the sky. Parameters, interesting. Okay, so you made this large-scale survey, and what were the most interesting results?
Well, we got an inkling of the existence of double profiles, which extended over a fair amount of the galactic plane, so we were able to pretty quickly, without needing to know a lot about astronomy, to postulate that this was going to refer to spiral arms in all probability.
Due to the galactic rotation?
Mm. Yes, we knew enough about that bit to realise what we could see. We couldn't tell much about the frequency shifts on the line, actually. Our frequency measurements weren't good enough to measure that.
You mean the actual velocity?
The actual velocities weren't very, well, they were hardly worth worrying about. We did calculate them, but they could have been in error quite large amounts. All we knew was that we were getting a double profile over a quite sizable amount of the galaxy in the Corona region.
Okay, let's just look at this paper in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research in 52, which presents your basic survey. First of all, you were switching at 25 hertz between two frequencies, 160 kilohertz apart, it says here. Now, was that...
Well, that's probably right. My memory's not all that good.
Okay, so...
That was as far as I could get apart. That's what it
was. But it wasn't 1.5 megahertz, and it was about 0.16 megahertz. And therefore, in fact, this is, you are losing some signal, because in some cases, of course, the line can be much broader than that.
Broader.
Mm-hmm. And so here you say the work described in this present paper was stimulated by a letter from Purcell to Pawsey. It was suggested an attempt should be made to confirm the discovery. The confirmation was announced by Pawsey.
The word is stimulated.
Right. But from a historical point of view, what you should have said there is that we had some attempts and then we moved faster or something.
We weren't seeking glory or anything. We were trying to do a job.
Just accuracy, yeah, okay. Mm. I was trying to get an idea of if you quoted the accuracy of your velocities here. The absolute frequency to receive signal is determined by the frequency.
100
kilohertz, so that's 25 kilometers a second, so that is sort of rough.
Yeah.
So, nevertheless, the relative velocity.
To measure this frequency, we were operating on something like a 274th harmonic of crystal.
Right. And crystal accuracies then were not as good as now, of course.
Right.
Nevertheless, the relative velocities on any given profile were quite accurate.
Yeah, but as you just pointed out, with only 160 kilohertz spacing between the channels, the shape of the profile wasn't very meaningful.
Well, it was distorted from what you would get with a broader band, but nevertheless, it was enough to show this sort of structure, as we see here in Figure 7.
Yeah.
No, that's not it.
No.
That's
the intensity around the galactic plane.
Here's one of your negative and then positive deflections, but we want to find a double peak here.
I think you'll find that...
Maybe... These are all single peaks.
Yeah.
Oh yes, here they are. Figures 10 and 11. So it was in the longitude range of 170 to 250 that the line... split up. One thing that's always struck me about this paper is that it seems like you're much more concerned with the difference in brightness as a function of longitude. In fact, here's a contour plot of brightness, very similar to what one would do in the continuum, rather than worrying about column density of hydrogen and these sort of things.
Right.
And I guess it was because you weren't just familiar with the interstellar medium.
That's correct. I don't think anybody was at that stage in the radio era.
Well, of course, Oort was, and van der Holst and the Dutch.
They were old-time optical astronomers.
Right. But Ewan and Purcell and your group at this stage...
We were simply radio people trying to provide another tool for detecting what these astronomers said was likely to be there.
But nevertheless, you showed that the line did split up, and it was probably due to spiral arms, which of course is a theme that followed on for a long time and still today. The brightness varied, and therefore probably either the width of the line or the amount of hydrogen was varying quite a bit.
Yeah.
What about the amount out of the plane versus in the plane? What did you make of that?
We said very much about it. We just
it's obviously
took
heavily
it for the
concentrated.
Fact that it was heavily concentrated on the plane.
Much more so than the low frequency galactic background.
Mm.
But you didn't make a particular note of
no,
that.
No.
But also, you must have been. Well, here you, for instance, talk about Oort's formula, so you must have been boning up on
in
galactic rotation.
In those few months after we did the observations,
right, right,
we started to become amateur astronomers.
That's interesting, though. You didn't consider yourself an astronomer, even though you've been working on the sun. And,
not really.
Yeah.
Our prime interest was in the equipment. And in fact, I mean, we just left a wartime situation. And what we knew quite strongly in our minds was that our success in radar was due to the fact that we did have people around who were, you know, very well trained in the techniques, who were just given an opportunity to apply them. At that stage, I think I'd have said, if anybody had asked me, that the whole worth of the research that we were doing at that time was to keep people at the forefront of the instrumental development, and that what was done with it would depend on circumstances.
Was sort of secondary, in a sense. Would you have said this all through the 50s?
I think I would have, yes.
Did all through the 60s?
I think I'd become more of a research-oriented...
When did that take place, that transition, would you say?
Well, I think that took place at the point where we, having got the four-channel system working, we were then able to make the first contact with the Magellanic Clouds. And at that point, I think I'd have said I was now reaching for the limits of the astronomy rather than of the equipment. We consciously went to the small Magellanic Cloud because various people had said that it was gasless, simply because they couldn't find the absorption there. Immediately we found that it wasn't the case, not by a long shot.
Right. But
and in fact, I think it's indicative of that change of attitude that I went on until I left radio physics, working on the small Magellanic Cloud. The whole thrust of my effort from then on was to try and elucidate something of the structure of that somewhat peculiar looking body.
When, if ever, would you have started calling yourself a radio astronomer?
I don't think I ever did. Other people did.
I
was conscious over the years of a growing contact with people overseas. And I suppose 1952 actually started that off. The ERSI meeting, really gave people the initial contact,
right,
who they could talk to and so on. And I think over the following 10 years, there was a very strong development in our contact with overseas people.
Before then, it had been sort of an insular...
Yes, we'd just been doing what was interesting from a radio point of view.
Interesting. Well, let's go back now to the 21 centimeter results. This first survey took roughly how long to do?
I think about three, perhaps 4 months. We were still observing around September, October of that year. And like a lot of these bits of hashed up equipment, we actually came to the end of our observing period. I'd have gone on observing for quite some time longer, I think. But various bits of the equipment fell to pieces. I refused to work anymore, and it was going to mean another fiddling session to get it all working up to scratch again. I think possibly even the fact that we were running into the hot months of the year and so on was maybe had something to do with it. But it was a toss-up then as to whether you stopped playing with that hashed-up equipment and thought about it properly or not. And we decided we had enough for the preliminary survey to give people an idea of where hydrogen was detectable.
Did you know that the Dutch, at about the same time, were undertaking a similar survey? Did you have that contact at that time?
Yes, we. I think by that time Frank Kerr had been detailed at Harvard to find out all he could about the astronomy involved, and he went on after that before he came back to Australia.
Right.
And then Christensen dropped out of the thing, went back to his solar work and his multi-element aerials and so on. And I think perhaps that's the point at which I made the transition from being purely instrumental to becoming interested more in the astronomy that was going on.
Well, now tell me how the transition took place from working with a different antenna, and then also working with Frank Kerr. How did that come about?
Well, Frank came back from Harvard, the decision having been taken while he was there that he would head a group to look into hydrogen line work. And in the meantime, we'd all been thinking about ways and means of building receivers and getting rid of those peculiar looking profiles, and we realised by then, of course, that the width of the profiles was much greater. We had to expand the range over which we were sweeping them.
So did you realise you were limited by that in this paper?
I think we did, although we may not have said so in the paper. I think what we noticed was that that changeover in the centre was sometimes very rapid. If it went across slowly, you could expect it was following a profile shape, but if it suddenly turned around and dashed across the thing, you knew you'd missed out on half the profile.
Right.
And, I think we were astute enough at that stage to realise that those profiles just didn't mean very much, except that there was some gas there.
Mm-hmm.
The actual intensities weren't all that important. We then had all sat down in our own little way to try and figure out what was the best approach for the future.
Who is it? Who are these people now?
Well, there would have been Kerr and Pawsey and myself and Christensen were still floating around there. I think we'd have been the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know when the decision was taken by Bowen and Pawsey, probably, that we would, in fact, invest in the problem, and they then held a meeting in Pawsey's office, at which, if I remember rightly, we were the only people present I can think of, I don't know for sure. But we were then all asked for basic ideas, and I think the day or two before I had said to Frank Kerr that I just couldn't see us having enough time if we kept on with this sweeping frequency thing. That, as I described it then, I thought we needed a comb of narrow band filters. And at the meeting, I'm not quite sure how it came up, but anyway, I was asked what I thought about it, and I put this idea forward. It received almost immediate acceptance from the others. I've got a feeling, though I can't substantiate it in any way, that Pawsey had also made the same decision in his own mind, thinking about it, that we had to somehow get a lot of chances. So then we sat down, and mainly Kerr and I, sat down and tried to figure out what was a practical initial effort. And we needed a bigger aerial, and we built the 36-footer to cover that requirement.
The reflector came from where?
We built it.
You built it from scratch, yeah. Basically. Designed it and had them shops.
Yes, the drawing office people did design work mainly and drew it up.
But that's what seemed to be not a minor task. It was a reasonably large area for those days.
Yes, it was a fair size, but it only moved in one direction.
And right.
Of course, as you see from the photographs, we adopted some rather easy methods of moving the thing with that big gear wheel.
Oh, yes.
That, we made that up out of a channel. It's a 3x1.5 channel across which a lot of bolts were placed.
I see.
That meshed in with the gear on top of the drive down here. All this was tied together by a concrete slab, otherwise it was disconnected. We also started off with a three-legged support for the feed.
Right.
That proved to be quite unstable in the circumferential direction, and we'd done it that way because initially we hinged the two bottom legs and had the top leg fed with a wire pulling it up so as we could let the feed down to the ground level.
Oh, I see.
Later we went over to the four-legged tripod and built this gadget.
And a tower that you moved under?
Allowed us to climb up to it. At the time, I suppose that was part of my experience. I was rather wedded to a detector in a waveguide rather than doing a coax system. That was because of my high frequency experience.
Mm-hmm.
This was about the changeover point. You couldn't find much bigger in that way.
Right.
But it did make it easy to combine the feed and the thing, because the horn feed made it easier to feed this dish. And on the dipole would have been quite a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we got to Parks, the dipole was still proving a problem, and once again I went on my earlier preference for a waveguide and made a circular waveguide and fed it with a dipole at the end of the circular waveguide.
I see. But you did have a horn feed on.
We had
on the Pottsville dish.
A horn feed on this. Well, I think we decided on four channels. We decided on 7 megacycles as the second intermediate frequency.
What about the width and spacing of the channels?
We decided on 40kc as being the minimum width that we could design into the into passive filters. Otherwise, we'd have been looking for enormous Qs, which we couldn't achieve.
Mm-hmm.
Were
you putting in some astrophysics now about the expected width of the lines and things like this?
Yes, I think Frank was feeding quite a bit of that information into the system, but I was resisting narrower channels very much.
I mean, he would have liked to have had narrower.
Oh, I think he would have liked narrower channels, but we'd have had to go to much lower intermediate frequencies, which would have meant then that we were coming up against our switching interval and so on. We had to compromise, and we compromised on the 40kc. We then had John Murray was brought into the system at that stage, I feel. We had to produce a local oscillator which would be settable in frequency.
Mm-hmm.
This was somewhat different to what we'd always been used to. We only had a simple free-running oscillator prior to that.
Right.
For this job, we had to make a multiplier chain from a crystal. And Murray built the whole of that unit. So we actually multiplied two channels, two frequencies, and switched them into the mixer.
But you were frequency switching it still, all four of the...
Yeah.
channels.
And then the long grind started.
How long did it take to build this, approximately?
Practically all of 1952, we ran into an